Many people love to garden, but only a few can claim to have a green thumb. Despite the best of intentions, you may have accidentally watered a plant to death or pruned a favorite tree into extinction, but there's still hope. After she had killed yet another indoor plant, Ruth Kassinger set about to learn the science behind botany, and in her latest book, A Garden of Marvels, she explains how plants eat air, how flowers have sex, and why people get a little uncomfortable around her anthurium flowers. It's published by William Morrow, and I'm very pleased to welcome Ruth Kassinger to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
You begin your book with a murder that took place in your very own home. What happened?
Well, I had a favorite kumquat tree. They're wonderful indoor plants, small trees that produce those wonderful golden orange fruits. And I had it for about 5 years. And it was doing beautifully. And then somehow it went downhill and most of its leaves fell off so that it looked like it had bare arms and green leafy gloves. And when I took it outside for its summer vacation, I thought, I've seen how my husband, who's a very good outdoor gardener, prunes his rose plants in the spring, and then they come back very full. And so I thought I would do that with my kumquat tree, and I gave her a pretty thorough haircut. And nothing good happened. She turned brown and brittle, and I realized I had killed her. And that inspired me to think, I probably need more information about the way plants work, more than what I can read on a hang tag, and I set out to become a better gardener by learning how plants work.
Well, didn't you also keep a near-dead plant behind a staircase for 13 years?
I did. Did
you know about plants needing sun? How many houseplants did you kill before you started working on this book?
Well, I have to say, I killed a fair number of them. In my defense, I'll tell you that most houseplants are from tropical areas, and here we are trying to raise them inside, often in northern climates. But still, I had a lot to learn.
Your book is about the science of plants, not a gardening how-to. How does understanding the difference between the xylem and the phloem make you a better gardener?
Well, for one thing, I mean, the xylem and the phloem tells you how plants move water up a xylem from the ground to the top of the plant. And the phloem is another set of tubes that take the sugars that are made in the leaves all around the plant. So that's a good thing to know for your general information. But some parts of understanding how plants work can have a really big impact on how you garden. For example, I had always assiduously bought sterile potting soil so that I wouldn't bring any bugs or viruses, plant viruses, into my new plants. But I discovered that it's very important that the soil not be completely sterile. There's a kind of fungus called mycorrhizae that grow on the roots of 90% of the world's plants. And without those fungi, your plant can't thoroughly take up water and nutrients. So one of the things that I learned to do is if I buy sterile potting soil, which you will often find in the garden center, better add mycorrhizae, which you can also buy there, to the soil so that your plant can eat and drink better.
Mm-hmm. But you also deal with simple stuff like, well, not so simple because I had to remember all the steps of it when I took a college biology class, photosynthesis. I'm not going to tell you how I remember the difference between the xylem and the phloem because it was too weird. But I had to come up with some things that sounded similar. But how does learning about photosynthesis help to make you a better gardener?
Well, it's important to understand that sunlight and carbon dioxide are the food of plants. Carbon dioxide is what produces the mass of plants. And sunlight is the energy that makes it all happen. And different plants have different requirements for light, and so understanding what the history of your plant is, meaning where did it evolve, was it the jungle floor or was it the open prairie, tells you a lot about how much light you have to give to your plants.
Well, one of the people you write about is the 18th century theologian, philosopher, and scientist Joseph Priestley, who's credited with discovering the gas that would later be called oxygen. How did he accidentally discover that mint cured what they called bad air at the time?
Well, he was very interested in what air really is. Until his time, about his time, air was considered to be an element and one substance. And he was one of the first people to discover that air is actually made up of different gases. And he was very interested in what we now know to be carbon dioxide, which is what plants take up, but what we exhale. And so he experimented with putting mice and moths and candles in an inverted glass bowl and discovered quickly that they expired in a short amount of time. And what he realized was that there was some sort of good air that was being taken out of the inverted glass bowl. And one day he decided just very casually that he would put a plant in that inverted bowl, fully expecting that it too would use up the good air, oxygen, and die. And what he found was it did just the opposite. It didn't die. It flourished. And this made him realize that there was another kind of air, not just good air. There was bad air and good air.
You write also that Priestley accidentally invented carbonated water. Now, that uses
yes.
carbon dioxide.
Yes. He was
the father of seltzer.
Yes, he was. He became aware that brewers in the brewing process produced carbon dioxide, and it would come off of the vats of beer. And he discovered that if he put a bowl of water near a vat of beer, that the carbon dioxide or the bad air would flow off and be absorbed into the water and make it bubbly and a little tart. One of the funny things is that although he invented this carbonated water, he was not the one who profited from it. The man who did was Joseph Schwepp, of the ginger ale company, who discovered how to bottle the thing properly so that the bubbles wouldn't disappear. And so Joseph Schwepp made a fortune, but Joseph Priestley did not.
You also point out that as late as the 17th century, intellectuals had a hard time distinguishing between plants and animals. They thought that they were all part of the same spectrum, because you also talk about the legend of the Boromitz plant.
Well, it's very interesting and hard for us to recapture, I think, that what was living and non-living was not very clear. People used to think that if you left lead or tin in the earth, that over time it would grow into something better. It would mature first into silver and then finally into gold. And one of the reasons why they had this idea that metals could grow in the earth was they found that if you mined a metal and then mined out all the metal so that nothing appeared to be left and then closed up the mine and left for a number of years, if you came back and reopened the mine, there would be more metals. And so they figured that things were growing. Metals were growing. Actually, what happened was there was erosion and the subsiding of the earth, and metal ore moved into the empty spaces, but that wasn't the way they saw it. And then the difference between a plant and an animal was very could be very hard to grasp. You would think that a plant is an immobile, insensate being. But some plants clearly moved. Some plants could twine up fence posts at an almost visible rate. There were plants like the sensitive plant, a kind of mimosa, that if you touched it, its leaves would close up quickly. And then there was a belief in this plant that grew out in the Asian steppes that people called the boromets. And this was a plant that had a central stalk, and out of the top of the central stalk grew a little lamb. And the little lamb had surpassingly white fleece, and everyone believed that that was where this fabulous soft white fabric came from Central Asia and Northern India. Of course, it was really the cotton plant, but because of some linguistic problems and because people just were not sure about what a plant was and what an animal was, they had a firm belief that a plant could produce a little lamb.
Oh, the wool that comes from the little lamb.
Right, the wool that comes from the lamb, which was actually cotton.
My guest is Ruth Kessinger. Her latest book is A Garden of Marvels, How We Discovered That Flowers Have Sex, Leaves Eat Air, and Other Secrets of Plants. And talking about leaves eating air, how did the Swiss professor Nicolas Theodore de Saussure discover that leaves eat air?
Well, he figured out that it was carbon dioxide that came from the air that became the substance of a plant. What happens is the leaves produce, using the carbon dioxide and linking hydrogen molecules with the carbon dioxide, produce carbohydrates, carbon and hydrogen. And that is what makes up 98.5% of the substance of a plant, leaves, stems, trunks. He really put paid to the misunderstanding that the substance of a plant came from the earth. Although plants are absolutely dependent on nutrients from the soil, those are minerals, and minerals that make up well less than 5% of the plant's mass.
And did people understand what he was saying right from the start? Because there's resistance often to scientific discoveries, I learned in my high school biology class when we talked about Gregor Mendel, for example. All of these things were going against conventional wisdom, weren't they?
By this time, a Frenchman named Lavoisier, Antoine de Lavoisier, had done the major footwork of figuring out some of the basics of chemistry, so that by the time Saussure was writing about carbon dioxide becoming carbohydrates, it was fairly easily accepted. The bigger problem with rejecting information that scientists were coming up with in this era were the questions of sex, and that flowers were all about sex. That was really hard for people to understand and agree with.
And the one who came up with the idea was an English physiologist, Nehemiah Grew. Great name for somebody involved with plants, Grew.
Right. It's true. And he was one of a number of ministers who were very important in the history of plants and botany.
Gregor Mendel was a monk.
That's right.
And Priestley, of course, was a theologian.
Exactly.
With a great name for a theologian, too.
Grew did have this inkling and wrote about the fact that he thought that pollen was the equivalent of sperm. He didn't he didn't do any experiments, and he kind of slipped it into a manuscript. And no one really commented on it because it was really an offensive idea. And one of the reasons it was offensive, the major reason, is because flowers had been so long associated with the Virgin Mary. In the backgrounds of Renaissance paintings, you almost always see flowers. And, of course, the angel Gabriel, when he arrives for the Annunciation, is carrying lilies. So the thought that flowers were all about sex was very hard for people to come to grips with. So it was not for another 30 years or more that that the idea became somewhat acceptable.
Well, the botanist Rudolf Jacob Kammerer advanced Crewe's theory on plant sex, but the theory, his theory, was considered repulsive.
It was really repulsive. I think of it a little bit as the way people felt when Sigmund Freud first started talking about children's sexuality. It just went against the grain. And it really wasn't until a particular day, June 10th, 1717, that the idea got broadcast and became acceptable.
And that was a speech by Sebastian Vaillant in the Jardin des Rois?
That's right. He was a surgeon who had become entranced with plants and had found a position at the King's Garden. But he was not allowed to really rise in the structure of the garden because he was not a nobleman and he was only a surgeon. And at the time, surgeons were associated with barbers, those people who had specialties with knives and were not university educated. But he understood what Kammerer had said and what Nehemiah Grewe had said. And one day, his superior, who was supposed to give a lecture, had to go out of town. And Vaillant was asked to step in. And instead of speaking about whatever his superior was going to speak about, he decided to have a lecture on the sexuality of plants. And at 6 a.m. on June 10th, 1717, he gave a really risque lecture where he compared plant sex with human sex. And, of course, it went over really well with all the students. There were medical students who were attending. But when his superior got back, the superior was just appalled, and the French Academy of Sciences refused to publish the lecture. Fortunately, Vaillant had some friends in the Netherlands and in England who published the lecture for him, and it was widely circulated. It was in part because it was a fun lecture, and he laid out the basics of sex, and Carl Linnaeus was highly influenced by that and came up with a new way of classifying plants according to their sexual characteristics.
Ruth, we have very little time, but when was it discovered that bees played a role in pollination?
That was even later, not until the mid-1700s. No one understood that the bees were doing anything more than getting the nectar, but finally a very careful, observant scientist figured out that they were carrying away pollen and depositing on nearby female flowers.
I'm not going to tell the story, because we don't have the time, about your husband describing your greenhouse as a bordello when the Arthurium are flowering. But that's the reason people read books. There's a lot of stuff here. We didn't get into Gregor Mendel, Charles Darwin, so many people playing a major role in our understanding of how plants work, to the point where certain fundamental facts of photosynthesis weren't discovered until the 1930s.
That's right.
Ruth Kassinger's book, A Garden of Marvels, How We Discovered That Flowers Have Sex, Leaves Eat Air, and Other Secrets of Plants, is published by William Morrow. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for inviting me.